Welcome to Packet Pushers. In this week's show, we've got an interview we recorded at Interop's Future of Networking Summit, held May 2nd and 3rd, 2016. The Packet Pushers planned this summit event, bringing together vendors, practitioners, and analysts to have technical discussions about where networking is headed over the next 5 or maybe even 10 years. This recording is an interview I did with Russ White at the very end of the summit, and it turned out to be a great way to close off the event. I'll drop you into the interview now, where from the stage, I kick things off. Well, we made it. We're into the last Future of Networking session. And what we've done here is we've brought up Mr. Russ White. He's what I would call a goner, a grumpy old network engineer. If you don't know Russ, let me do a quick intro. Russ is a longtime industry pro. He's worked both at vendors and at customer sites. Russ is well known as a networking subject matter expert. He's authored or co-authored several books. You'll see his name at the top of many IETF RFCs. Let me continue. He's played a huge role in the design of several Cisco certification programs over the years. And now you're working on LinkedIn, Russ. Talk about that for a minute.
Yeah, I'm on the network architecture team at LinkedIn, or just the architecture team. I'm a network architect. I don't know if Sean is here. He might be here. He's the other one of the other guys on the architecture team. So I'm working around next-gen data center designs, BGP security, reformatting and thinking through the LinkedIn core. By the way, who all thinks that LinkedIn has a small network? Yeah. When I went to Nanog last time after going to LinkedIn the first time, people said, aren't you just on cloud, public cloud? No. So to give you a little bit of clue about the LinkedIn network, our current data center build is about 100,000 bare metal servers. We are layer 3 to the top of rack, all IP. If one of our internal customers comes and says we want layer 2 on the top, we say good luck with that, because we don't do layer 2 in our data center fabric. So, anyway, it's a pretty big network. We have 4 data centers right now, and we are doing lots and lots of cool stuff. So, that's kind of what I do right now at LinkedIn, mostly just a routing geek and working on stuff that needs to be done there.
So I'm going to be asking Russ a bunch of questions about the future of networking, just some open-ended questions to get his goner take, grumpy old network engineer take on things. Now, Russ, you have published a book here, co-authored a book that you're going to be giving away at the end of this session, right?
You're going to be giving it away.
I'm going to be giving it away. So this is Russ and Jeff Tansour, Navigating Network Complexity. How many of you have this book already? I saw at least one person came up and asked Russ to sign it.
Okay, just a couple.
A copy of this is going to go to the person who asks Russ the best question at the end of our session today.
All according right. According to Ethan's.
Oh, I'm the judge now.
You're okay. The judge.
Okay. I accept bribes. I'll be right up front about that. Okay, Russ, so I want to start a section here on fundamentals. How are the fundamentals of networking changing? Question one, are we stuck with Ethernet forever?
Well, it depends on your perspective of what you mean by Ethernet.
Ooh. Okay, so tell me why you put it that way. Go ahead.
So when I first started in the networking industry, when tires were square, Ethernet was CSMA CD. Does anybody remember that? Yeah, right, exactly. Maybe you're as old as I am then. Listen, Ethernet ain't that anymore, right? So we will always be stuck with the Ethernet technology name, Ethan. But will we be stuck with Ethernet forever? Well, Ethernet has changed so much in the last 20 years, I'm not sure you can actually call it Ethernet anymore. But we just seem to keep calling it the same thing over and over and over again.
So it's an access layer framing. It's going to be that anyway.
It's going to be that anyway. Yeah. Right.
Whatever else it
is. Whatever else it is. Yep, that's what it's. Okay. We're going to call it Ethernet.
IPv6. Seems like we boiled the ocean. Implementation is kind of hard, depending on your point of view. Vendor support is unpredictable. Some would say the dual stack is the easy part. So what year is going to be the year of IPv6?
Oh, boy, do I get to play Jeff Houston now? I don't have a good Australian accent, so I can't play Jeff Houston very well. Maybe Greg should do it. Anyway, so my opinion of IPv6 is it's going to happen, but it's going to happen very slowly, and there'll always probably be both V4 and V6 in the real world. For an instance, in LinkedIn, we're going V6 on our fabric interior. Within our fabrics and on our core, we are probably going to have a V4 termination point for as far as we can tell forever. We don't ever see V4 going away. And there's been some moves in the IETF to make this V4 thing go away, but honestly, V6 is kind of hard. If you've not messed with it, Ed Horley might be around here someplace. He can tell you war stories about doing V6. And, you know, I've messed with it on a couple of networks trying to get it up and running. And, you know, Jeff is kind of right. We kind of took on too much at once, and we kind of tried to boil the ocean and do a little bit too much maybe. It'll probably eventually deploy because we don't have a lot of other choices right now. But it'll be painful, and it'll be long, and it'll never be completely V6 world, I don't think.
Okay. Is HTTP the new TCP?
Oh, wow, that's a weird question. Is HTTP the new TCP?
Forget layering and all that.
Yeah, forget layering and all that stuff. Yeah. Actually, I don't think so. I think that HTTP is becoming like BGP, the stuff protocol, and we're stuffing too much in it. And I think with QUIC and other things, we're going to see some people back off a little bit of using HTTP for everything. So, yeah, I mean, I think that HTTP will, you know, you still have FTP, you still have SFTP, you have other things. I don't think that HTTP is the new TCP for everything. I think it's becoming pretty much ubiquitous because we're stuffing too much in it. Eventually, we'll have to back off and do something different.
Okay. In the new unikernel movement, we strip out extraneous anything, drivers, features, and have the barest possible environment that allows for an environment to interact with the outside world and run an application. That's the unikernels in a nutshell there. Can networking learn from this? Are we too focused on backwards compatibility?
Oh, my goodness, backwards compatibility. So I could tell you a story. When I first started working on XR, the name of the mailing list inside Cisco was called lowercase c. You have to figure out why it was called lowercase c on your own. But I'll give you a hint. We changed our logo when I was working at Cisco. So the intro mailing list was called lowercase c. And a much part, now I don't know how many of you realize how old XR is, but much of the discussion around XR kernel was around exactly this topic. How much should be in the kernel and how much should not? Eventually, we decided to go, when I was working at Cisco, I remember this as many years ago, we decided to go to a microkernel, what we called at that time a microkernel, which stripped everything, including IPC, out of the core kernel and made them all DLLs, loadable modules that you could stick onto the kernel itself. I think you're seeing much the same today. In the world of network or in the world of OSs, I think we're moving back to that. I think what happens is we build microkernels or we build these unikernel type things. Then we tend to throw stuff at them until they become bloated hogs. And then we go, ooh, got to stop doing that. And we go back to this stripped kernel thing again. Networking, I think, could learn from this because, again, how much stuff have we stuffed into HTTP? How much stuff have we stuffed into BGP? There are jokes around the IETF around renaming BGP the STP, Stuff Transport Protocol, because it pretty much does everything anymore, right? And it's getting a little bit crazy. So could we learn something by backing off, taking on individual problems, stop trying to boil the ocean with every protocol we develop and everything that we do, and make things a little more stripped down? Yes. Okay, in complexity terms, what we're doing is we're trading off right now. We're stuffing a lot of stuff into protocols. We're making the protocol very, very, very thick in order to reduce our interaction surfaces because we want to use one protocol for everything. That's one way of skinning the cat. The other way of skinning the cat is to have a lot of different protocols that do different things. You have more complex interaction surfaces, but the protocols themselves are a lot simpler. I really think that's the direction we need to go anyway, is the simpler protocols, more interaction surfaces.
Okay, new section, software-defined networking. So, question one, we've been blathering on about SDN for 5 years now, right? Maybe more. How do you, Russ White, define SDN at this point, and what value do you think it will ultimately bring to the industry?
Pure SDN? Unicorns. Is that definitive enough?
We want a little more.
Okay. So there's this little thing called CAP theorem. If you don't know it, you should go read about it. Consistency, accessibility, partitionability. It's a very old thing. The founder or the originator of CAP theorem now says that there are some issues in the way we treat it. It's a set of bundle of trade-offs instead of being absolutes, which I agree with. But overall, no matter how you try to solve the control plane problem, the control plane is a distributed database near real time. You get to choose, make your choice between eventual consistency or total accessibility or complete partitionability. That's the way it works. Routing protocols as a distributed database tend to rely on or fall back to eventual consistency. We don't like this very often because it means you get things like microloops. And you get the internet that never actually converges, but that's because the flap rate and the change rate in the routing table is faster than you can converge a BGP table of 500,000 to a million routes across 30, 40,000 ASs scattered throughout the entire world, just the reality of the situation. So SDNs, to me, are just a different way of doing that trade-off. Instead of having partitionability, you pull everything in. You have immediate consistency, but there are trade-offs, and there are problems with that solution. So at LinkedIn, we're not actually doing SDNs. We're doing what we consider to be a programmable disaggregated network, which means, boy, that was fancy. Did you like that, Ethan?
Programmable disaggregated
yes,
networks.
Yes, yes, very good. Can you say it five times fast?
I'm not even going to try.
So from our perspective, the distributed control plane should remain distributed. The problem is we're stuffing too much stuff in the distributed control plane. We're trying to stuff policy, reachability, reaction to topology changes, everything in one protocol. Go back to your microkernel question. Stop doing that. So the way we're looking at it is we want to have policy that sits outside the network as an SD overlay, a software-defined overlay, making the network programmable. Ooh, that was a bad pop on that B. Anyway, making the network programmable, but don't try to do everything in a software-defined centralized controller. Figure out what to put where, intelligently scale the network in the right way, and put the right stuff in the right place. And stop trying to do everything from one end of the pendulum to the other end of the pendulum. You just get dizzy after a while, by the way, if you ride the pendulum long enough.
So my next question is really closely related to what you just said. Customers seem to want homogenous products, products that they can treat the same no matter what it says on the label, Cisco,
right.
German, whatever.
Yes.
Can we ever make networking a predictable consumable?
Yes and no. How's that for a good answer? I think at some levels you can. That's one reason that LinkedIn is disaggregating is because we're trying to separate our software buy from our hardware buy and our control plane from our NAS. And we're trying to do this in order to make it more predictable and consumable in a way that our server guys can manage our network instead of us having a specialized NOC that just works on whatever particular vendor you happen to buy this week. So there is something to go on there. Yeah, you're laughing over there, Ethan. So I think that in a sense, there's hyperconvergence, which I think, so in my mind, in the next 5 to 6 years, you're going to see the networking market or the IT market break down into multiple tiers. You're going to have smaller people running mostly hyperconverged stuff because you buy it, it comes as a rack, poof, it works, I plug it in, and it's just there. If they're really small, they might be totally on the public cloud. There's going to be some mixture between public cloud, public services, and the hyperconverged phase. When you get big enough to own your own data centers, you're probably going to eventually move into more of a disaggregated perspective, which is I buy my software from company A, I buy my hardware from whoever I buy it from, and I try to do as much as I can to use open source and other tools to make it work better. And I think as that ecosystem grows up and as the ways of working on things grow up, we'll see more of that type of thing happening. So you're going to see the Google, Facebook, Microsoft type of thing where they do their own thing kind of move down stack to the midsize, and you're going to see hyperconvergence take over the midsize to small, and the small is going to be primarily on public cloud services. So does that mean it's more consumable for the smaller end, lower end? I should say smaller end, yes. And I have a very big caution about this. Most people consider scale, large numbers of routers, to be the definition of complexity and difficult to manage. I totally disagree with that. I think services offered has much more to do with complexity in your network and what you're actually trying to do and whether you can do these consumable services or not than the actual number of routers that you own. So just as an example, Telepost Greenland is a big network, not a big network I worked on, 60,000 customers. 60,000 end-user customers, not a big network. I mean, LinkedIn has 400 million customers, okay? So we talk about scale sizes. It's completely different. But Telepost Greenland is offering L2 VPN, L3 VPN, voice over IP, and all sorts of other services, video on demand, web hosting, and lots of other things to that 60,000 customers. Makes their network very, very difficult to manage for that size of a network.
So I'm going to drill into some specifics that came up during the summit regarding making networking a predictable consumable, some technologies that are being developed and worked on. One of those is OpenConfig and the models that are being developed there.
I love OpenConfig. Is that enough?
Tell us more.
I think anytime you can get – so this was the promise of SNMP that never succeeded. And I think, however, anytime you can get to the point where you have a set of models that everyone can write to for information, it's never going to be a 100% solution. Okay, let's be realistic. I'm not going to be able to get my Broadcom chipset counters at depth out of an OpenConfig model. It's just not going to happen. But I can, if I can get most of my routing stuff, most of my fan trace stuff, most of my EEPROM stuff, things like that, interface state, out of an OpenConfig model and save myself 75 to 80% of the work I have to do in network management, and I can actually use a Yang interface, that makes my life much, much easier in the mid to large scale. So this is where it does become much more consumable, right? I mean, just think about this as a bare concept. Does everybody know what Kafka is? Does anybody know what Kafka is? It's a pub-sub kind of messaging bus type thing. Just think about if you could take your Yang models, an OpenConfig model, and work it instead of having point-to-point connections or something like SNMP to all your devices in your network, have a Kafka pub-sub message bus on your entire network that's consuming all the data, and then I can push configuration to those devices using a pub-sub model rather than doing something else. It's a really cool concept. There's a lot that you could do with that to make the network a lot more consumable.
Related to that, then, would be network intent. And I bring it up in the context of OpenConfig in the sense that if we got intent right, and I'm going back to David, I don't know if you heard David speak on Monday, but he made the point that if we do the abstraction right between northbound and southbound, you can express intent, and then mappings on the southbound side are going to handle the specifics for you, but we'll have that kind of universal interface to express what we're looking for. Is that plausible, or can we really pull this off as an industry?
So can we pull this off as an industry? So 2 points to consider. The first is that when you move to intent, you are moving to a very high level of abstraction. Abstraction causes you to reduce or to lose optimization. Just a fact of life, okay? I can give you lots of examples, but I don't want to go into a lot of details, but just think about TCP. TCP runs on top of IP, which runs on top of Ethernet. You know that if you really think about it, Ethernet and lower levels know, the lower layers know everything that TCP is trying to guess at with RTT. But it's abstracted out by IP. So you lose some form of optimization when you abstract out all that information through the IP layer and lay TCP on top of it. So network intent as an abstractor is going to cause that type of sub-optimization someplace in the system. You just have to find it. Is it worthwhile in your particular situation, in your particular network, is questionable. Just depends on your network and what you're doing. So the second point that you got to remember is that abstractions leak. All abstractions leak. Quite often, a lot of the troubleshooting problems you run into is that you have leaky abstractions everywhere in your network, and you have run little hacks around all these leaky abstractions to make things work.
Give us an example of that.
Well, a very, very simple example is pulling the metric off of the highest cost component when you do an aggregation. When the highest component goes away, your metric changes and your aggregation is effectively worthless because you've had to compute routes throughout your entire network, even though you're computing them on the aggregate instead of computing them on the individual. They're more specifics. So what you do to fix this is what? Anybody have any idea? Right. We nail up statics. Okay? It's a beautiful idea, but I'm actually causing configuration changes in order to stop a leaking abstraction. So I'm therefore making my network more complex to stop that. All abstractions leak, just depends on what level and what they do. So now what's going to happen with network intents? The same thing. It's a very high-level abstraction. You're going to have leaks in the abstraction. So if you do this, you have to be very intentional about managing the leaks and not doing hacks around the leaks all the time. Okay? So there are positives and negatives here. It just depends on what you're trying to do and where you're trying to go with it. Do I see mid-scale? Do I see LinkedIn ever doing network intent? Probably not, because we're too obsessive about low-level stuff to do that. So it just depends.
Back to hyperconvergence for a minute. You brought it up and said where you thought it fit in the market. Does hyperconvergence as a stack absorb networking eventually?
I think on the very low end, it absorbs a lot of networking, a lot of data center networking. I don't think it absorbs campus. I don't think it absorbs WAN. I'm not as you'll probably ask me about SD-WAN in a minute, won't you?
No. I don't think that's
on the list. I'm not as upbeat on SD-WAN as Greg is. I think that SD-WAN is going to be a last-mile technology primarily before it's over with. Just my opinion on the way things actually work, and don't tell anybody I said that in the SD-WAN community because I have a lot of friends there. But, oh, this is being recorded. I'm in trouble. Anyway, I think SD-WAN becomes a last-mile technology and a hub-and-spoke technology for specific situations over the long haul. So does hyperconvergence take it over? I think we see hyperconvergence taking over the small stack data center, and we see it taking over some of the campus stuff. And I actually see hyperconvergence is a really cool way to do a lot of distributed processing rather than hunkering down one big data center. If you do the right thing with hyperconvergence, you could actually distribute your processing throughout all of your remote sites and offices and stuff and be a little more intelligent about what you're doing, have a distributed database or a distributed data center fabric type of thing. So that's kind of where I see that.
Okay, I'm going to move the topic on to open networking and some things related to open networking.
Uh-oh.
When is merchant silicon not good enough?
Oh, wow. How about very rarely? When you are working around, so if I were level three and I were looking at my EBGP edge, I would be looking at price performance and not whether or not it's merchant silicon. Okay? Because I have a lot of filtering issues. Basically, anytime I get into high touch, is where merchant silicon tends to fall apart, just from a performance perspective. If I have a lot of filters and I have a lot of unicast RPF and things like that going on at my edge, I'm probably going to be pushed into using non-merchant silicon. Now, will merchant silicon eventually back into those things and do those things? Sure, they will. But there's always going to be a time lag between custom silicon and merchant silicon, and custom silicon's always going to play in that time lag. So will the market be as big for custom silicon? Probably not.
But generally speaking, you're saying even today, merchant silicon has got the price performance advantage. It does what most people need.
It does 90% of what most people need today. Yeah. There's always going to be a 10 to 20% lag in there where you're going to end up with custom silicon, but that's going to be the way it is.
Another question. Are there too many open networking projects for them all to survive? And if we say that there are, could you suggest on how we might pick out the winners?
Answer the first question, yes. This is the real problem with open source, and I've talked about this in blog posts before, is that open source is a beautiful thing, but open source is a bad thing because open source is too easy to fork and build your own thing because you don't like what other people are doing. So you end up with yet another project sitting around the corner doing something. All right, so yes, there are too many open networking things that are open source today. Some of them are going to die. How do you pick which one is going to win? That's a really good question, Ethan, and I wish I knew the answer to it right now because it's actually a problem I face right now. I think part of the problem is that Open source in the routing space has a lot of different things going on. There are overlay routing things like OVS, and there are bare metal routing things like ONL and SONIC and FBOSS. If you don't know what those are, you get to go look them up on the internet. There's that search thing that you can do. Anyway, so I think that there are too many requirements. There are too many requirements that are different to make those things merge, so you're always going to see a top dog in each of those areas in some way, and it's going to be really hard to make some of those projects cross over and do more than one thing. That's not a bad thing. Microkernels, right? Focus, do what you do well, let the rest of it fall by the wayside. Let somebody else pick it up. So I don't know how to tell you to pick winners, though, unfortunately.
Yeah, neither do the rest of us. That's why I asked you. You're supposed to know. So another very related question. Standards bodies and open source seem to be at odds lately. You've worked on both sides of this equation.
Yep.
Do you agree with me that that's true? They are indeed at odds. And is that going to remain true 5 years from now?
I think that the perception that they're at odds is a bit larger than the reality. That's my impression. I know the IETF in particular is working very, very hard to integrate and work with the open source community as much as possible. The problem is often that the open source fork problem runs up against the idea of the standards process. We don't like the standards processes are slow. They're slow for a reason most of the time, which is to try to prevent the fork problem, although, frankly, that doesn't always solve the forking problem, right? But we try to. I mean, it's just a matter of who is better at what part of the game. Ideally, to me, open source would be a fertile breeding ground for new ideas, and standards bodies, open standards would be a fertile place to actually figure out who the winners and the losers are among those fertile ideas. We're far from that ideal today. Mm. Is that helpful?
Fair enough.
Okay. I mean, that's kind of my take on it.
But you don't think standards bodies are going to go away or fade into irrelevance because open source is the what were we saying a couple of years ago? The code is the coin of the realm, and so if you make something and people use it, therefore it becomes a de facto standard?
No, I don't think so. I think because of the various problems with open source and the way that we pile projects on top of each other and stuff like that, and the other problem with open source is that it's awful lot easier to develop a new transport protocol than it is to use what's out there, right? I mean, Qwik is a great thing. I like Qwik. I've looked at the code. I've pulled the code and messed around with it a little bit. I don't know if you know what Qwik is, but it's a competitor transport to TCP. SCTP is a good thing. They're all good things. But without a standards body to get everybody to agree to use one thing, you're going to have 5,000 Qwiks and 5,000 TCPs, and every application is going to devolve to its own transport. Hmm. And that's a bad thing. And so you need some type of funnel to stop that from happening. And again, that's I think that's where open standards should play, but, you know, it's a hard transition to make, figure that out.
I would agree with you that we're already looking at that need for a funnel just because of what we were saying before, the plethora of open source projects that are out there, a lot of overlap, a few unique differences.
Yep.
Why can't we all start to funnel these down and agree on the standards and get along?
Right.
Hi, this is Drew Conry Murray from the Packet Pushers, and I'm just going to take a moment to thank today's sponsor, GNS3. You know GNS3 for their network lab software. Now they've started a training academy, including the Practical SDN and OpenFlow Fundamentals course from David Bombal, and Packet Pushers listeners can get 50% off. If you're looking for a practical, hands-on, real-world approach to learning and implementing SDN and OpenFlow, this GNS3 Academy course offers a unique way to learn about SDN with no risk, using your own laptop along with free or demo software. In this course, instructor and CCIE Emeritus David Bombal demonstrates SDN and OpenFlow in detail, covering everything from the basic definition of SDN to capturing messages with Wireshark and even building your own SDN switch with a Raspberry Pi. The first 50 Packet Pushers listeners to register receive the course for 50% off. So register now. How? Go to academy.gns3.com and use the coupon PacketPushers, all one word, to get your discount. And thanks to GNS3 for being a sponsor. And now back to the show.
All right, questions from the audience for Russ. What have you got?
Okay. Very, very good question. Question is, what about certifications? Are they viable for enterprise folk? Should, you know, for full stack engineers, et cetera? Okay. So I actually don't hold a lot of Cisco certifications. I only hold three, CCIE, CCDE, and CCAR.
Just those three?
Just three.
Yeah.
Just those three. And by the way, I cheated on the DE and the AR.
What do you mean? You were grandfathered in?
I was grandfathered in. So I'm not like a 6X CCIE or something. In fact, when people tell me that they're going after their second CCIE, my answer is often, you know, that's okay, but I wouldn't. Personally, I would go for a CCDE. I would go for a CISSP. I would go for a bachelor's degree. I would go for a master's degree. I would go for something else. You know, unless you're going to, even if you're working in a NOC full-time, having that much depth of knowledge in one area in troubleshooting, I'm not necessarily certain that it gets you anywhere as a network engineer. Gets you a lot of bragging rights. Does it make you a full-stack engineer? I don't know. So my take on it is the certifications are good. They're useful. My main thing about certifications is this. They are designed by people who have spent many, many years in the networking industry and have spent a lot of time thinking about what you need to do or what you need to know, the skill set you need to have to be a good network engineer. There's absolutely nothing wrong with bashing your head against getting a CCIE or a CCDE or even the CCAR. Just hope I'm not sitting on your board for the CCAR. But anyway, the point is you just need to think about, be intentional about the knowledge you're trying to learn. Be very intentional about what you know right now that's going to get you to full stack. Certifications are good. Nothing wrong with them. Don't major on getting every certification under the sun, however. Focus on getting other things. I mean, in my case, yeah, I hold a CCIE, CCDE, CCAR. Good. I also have a master's degree in network design and architecture. I also have a master's degree in theology, and I'm also getting a PhD in philosophy. So, you know, be broad. Think about more things than just the next CCIE or the next JCIE or whatever the case might be, right?
So that's, when you install a router, can you tell say what it means to the world?
Yes. I talk to my routers.
That's right. Another question for us?
Okay. Summarizing the question. We talk a lot about being full stack, about breadth of knowledge, things like that. But my boss wants to know what we're doing to make the application run with the network better. Are we doing enough, even at Interop, to address DevOps and other things from that side? I'm going to let Ethan answer the rest of it, other than saying again, Agile is dead.
Why are you putting this on my plate to answer this? You know, I'll give you my 2 cents on making the application run better with the network. That's why I started up the DataKnots podcast with Chris, to have those conversations, because it is about, forgetting the technical side for a minute, it's about getting out of the silos and getting together with the other people that work on your team to develop a cross-silo understanding of exactly how that application is delivered. And you can't do that if you're looking at things from the network perspective or the storage perspective, the security perspective, et cetera. It's got to be everyone working together, understanding how each of the pieces of infrastructure are drawn upon to deliver the app, and then putting, as a team, that solution together, what that's going to be. Now, we're seeing container networking rise. We're seeing cloud-native applications become part of normal conversations. All of that new architecture only happens and goes into place when everyone's out of their silos and working together. That also happens in conjunction with the development team. In other words, the developers aren't people that you hate to talk to because they're always making weird demands and don't seem to understand how the infrastructure works. Now it's a two-way conversation between the application people and the infrastructure people, so that there is a mutual understanding of what the application needs from a developer perspective and what the infrastructure can do from a delivery perspective, everyone agreeing on how this is going to work and then putting the systems in place to make that happen, which is something we haven't been doing in IT, at least not in any IT shop that I've been in, with rare exception, do those conversations happen. And so it's a shift in how IT is organized. It's a people problem more than anything to get to that next place.
And we're part of the people problem, by the way. Not just because we don't – I don't know how many sessions we have on DevOps at Interop. You know, I'm just a silly speaker. I don't do much with this type of stuff. But with choosing who does what and everything else. But we are part of the problem, right? We haven't learned Rule 11. We haven't memorized it. RFC 1925, Rule 11, go read it, take it to heart, memorize it. Not because it's just funny, but because it's true and it's your friend, okay? We need to stop focusing on the CLI and start thinking about theory and why things work the way they do and how things work the way they do. Again, breadth of knowledge is really important. So putting the development and the network operations team together, right? Again, disaggregation. I want my routers in my data center to look like Unix servers, okay? Very, very simple. I want to use my message bus to control my policy. I don't want to have separate stuff to do this. I want to simplify, but I also want to make sure I'm using the right protocols for the right reason and stop using BGP as the stuff protocol and HTTP as the stuff protocol, right? So this is the way it actually works.
Other questions for Russ?
Okay, so how do you keep things simple when the requirements become complex? First of all, I would argue that complexity and simplicity are moving scales. Hard problems require complex solutions, fact of life. Can't get around it, just the way it works. So simplicity is a matter of, I would call it more elegance, that you're more concerned with making the problem fit or the solution fit the problem rather than making it absolutely simple. The second thing is, go back to what Ethan just said, the conversation between the applications and the business and the network. I'm just going to tell you that for far too long, we network engineers have jumped or said how high whenever somebody says jump. We don't have the conversation. Someone says, I need layer 2 on top of my entire 200,000 server farm rack data center fabric, and we say, let me go deploy something very complex to make that work. Someone says, I want my Trill-B routers to be able to be scattered throughout my entire network, no matter where they might happen to live, and make it all work with spanning tree seamlessly. And we go out and invent nicknames and do all sorts of overlay stuff, okay? No, okay? It's perfectly fine to have complex networks to solve hard problems, but we need to get in the habit of having the conversation with the guys developing the applications and the business drivers, the business people, to help them understand. But we need to learn how to talk to them in these terms. We need to learn how to say, all right, you want a layer 2 overlay. Let me tell you what that's going to do to your OPEX. Let me tell you what putting firewalls in this data center fabric is going to do to your OPEX. Let me think about what this is going to do to your traffic flows and your ability to move servers around. We need to learn how to put it in terms that other people can understand and try to get people to realize that the complexity just can't be tossed over the cubicle wall into my cube any more than I can toss it over the developer's cube and call it DevOps or SDN, okay? We've got to learn to work together with this. The fire hose of complex things. Yes, I know. You know, when I first started working in Cisco Tech in 1996, we called it sipping from the fire hose. And it was really, really, really bad for a long time when I first started in Cisco Tech. But I'm going to refer you back to Rule 11. It's your friend, okay? Nothing is ever new invented in the networking industry. It just has different names, a different CLI, a different GUI, and it's applied to different problems. Okay, all these technologies, there are only so many ways you can correct errors. There are so many ways you can compute best path or shortest path. There are so many ways that you can distribute a database. And, you know, you have the CAP theorem that you have to deal with somehow. There's only so many choices within those things you can make. It's the way it is. And so my thesis throughout, well, not throughout my networking career, but since I went to Global Escalation in Cisco, was to learn how things are done and why they're done that way rather than learning the CLI. And so that's just the way I've dealt with the fire hose. And I don't know of another better way of doing it or saying it. I just don't know. It's just the way I've dealt with it.
My two cents, I sit in the middle of that because of what Greg and I and Drew do, all this information coming at us constantly that we're supposed to have some knowledge of and maybe some opinion about. And I've gotten to a point where I can't. So, yeah, I do some of that, but I have to pick a few things that I'm going to latch onto that seem to have the most value and dig into those things and let the other things go where they're going to go. Be aware of them, but I'm not going to dig into them. I'm going to park on the things that are most interesting and valuable to me in my particular situation and dive into it. You saw a little bit of that this morning in my presentation. I decided to spend hours going through that RFC and thinking it through and what does this really mean and is this a useful bit of knowledge, and then talked about it. You know, it was a choice I made. Because I read that, I didn't read something else during that time. Other questions for Russ?
What key skills do I see for the next 5 to 10 years for a network engineer? Communication skills, broadening out, learning a little bit about business. You don't have to learn top line, bottom line, all that stuff, but you do need to learn a little bit how to talk to business people. Communication skills are really important. The other thing is to start thinking in terms of, as a key skill, learn to think like a coder. You don't have to learn to code, but, you know, one of the things I've discovered in my life is, my history is I was in Cisco engineering for 12 years, 10 years. I had commit privileges on XR and iOS. If you run Classic or you run XR, you're probably running some of my code, by the way. Now you can run from the room screaming if you want to. Greg is getting up and getting ready to run from the room screaming. But seriously, I mean, I learned discipline around how to manage a code base and how to approach problems that I didn't know before I actually had to commit into iOS and XR. And so I'm not telling you you need to be a coder. I'm telling you need to learn the discipline of being a coder, of dealing with problems like a coder does. It's not an exclusive skill set. I think you need to think like a network engineer when you need to think like that, and you need to think like a coder when you need to think like a coder. I think you need to be bivocational in many ways, as we would say in the philosophy world. In many ways, around these things, we need to pick up other skill sets, and we need to learn how to do other things and learn how to think in other ways. A friend of mine emailed me the other day and said, so I've been reading your blog post, and I just realized all these algorithms, man, they're kind of cool, right? What can I learn from the 20 or 30 or 50 years that coders have been doing algorithms? Oh, well, there's an interesting question. There's entire books on algorithms that show you how to sort out whether it's O log n or O n log n or n squared or whatever the case might be. That'll help you get your head around certain problems that are hard to get around other ways. So I think there's that learning how to think like a coder is one. Rule 11 is another one. I really insist on rule 11, guys, you know, or everybody in here, guys, girls, and, you know, I say guys by habit. But anyway, rule 11, I really insist on rule 11, learn to think like a coder and learn to communicate. Really learn to communicate.
Now, you mentioned communicating and being able to talk to business people in their language. How do you get a skill set like that?
Wow. Hard question. Talk to kids. Yeah. Okay. I learned more about how the internet really works by teaching a class to high schoolers on how the internet really works. Go out and teach stuff. Teach basic stuff to local high schoolers, whatever you can come up with. Teaching is a great way to learn that skill. Another way is to go sit in business meetings randomly and just try to decipher what they're saying. You know, bring your Dilbert buzzword bingo card. It's fine. That's okay. But just try to figure that stuff out a little bit. I think those are useful, just a useful skill set to have. Come to Interop and present. I heard Ethan say that he was always dying for good presenters.
That is true. I thought you were going to say that I was always dying to present. I'm like, that's not true. Any more questions from Mr. White? Yes, ma'am.
How can learning to think like a coder help you reduce complexity in your network? I think that the concept of processing problems in a linear fashion, thinking through APIs, I think that's a huge deal. I mean, one thing I learned when I was coding for iOS and XR is that the API is the ticket. Everything works around the API. Starting to think about the BGP to OSPF or BGP to ISIS interface being an API, what does that mean? The aggregation points being an API, what does that mean? What do these surfaces look like? What does this interaction look like? I think those are big things. The law of leaky abstractions is a coding thing that I pull over all the time into my networking field. There's a blog post on my blog going up this week talking about quicksort and troubleshooting skills. Now, see, you're going to have to go look at my blog and see what I'm talking about. Quicksort and troubleshooting skills, that's an interesting concept, isn't it? But nonetheless, I think learning the algorithms, learning the process, learning the discipline of doing the right thing, thinking in terms of, if I were to be hit by a bus tomorrow, could somebody else take this over and work on it? Or if my junior guy sitting in the NOC gets called out at 3 o'clock in the morning and has to explain this situation to a TAC engineer who speaks a different language as their native language. Now what do I do, right? These are issues coders deal with all the time. And you have to learn how to build things, self-documenting or doing a lot of documentation, learning how to document in line. These are types of skills that I think you pick up when you do coding that are really, really helpful to the network engineer.
More questions before we close our session today?
No. So my take on Rule 11, the question is, we have a lot of disruptive technologies, so where does that fit in with Rule 11 and the concept that nothing new is invented? No, my take on this is this. Okay. Unstructured data has been around a long time. If you understood the theory behind unstructured data, the first time a Hadoop database smacks you upside the head, you're going to understand what it's doing without having to dig in to how it actually works in deep detail. That helps you build, how would I put this? It's a mental map. Okay? Rule 11 can provide you with a mental map over all the technologies in the world that have ever been invented. And as you encounter them, if you build a mental map, so, you know, you encounter OSPF and you work in a network that's OSPF all the time. Next week you get a new job, it's ISIS.
Yep.
Okay. Why did you freak out? It's still Dijkstra. It's still flooding. There are some differences. There are different address formats. But it's still Dijkstra. And it's still flooding. Okay? So learning the bits and pieces that are different is a lot easier than learning the CLI for every new thing and never learning the theory. So that's where I go with that, and that's where I always go with that. Okay, so I don't know if I should say this here or not, but I'm going to say it anyway. Jeff and Ethan and I are actually working on a book in this area, if that's helpful information.
So the BGP question is this. You've been calling it the stuff protocol, and maybe we shouldn't be stuffing so much stuff into it. So what are you suggesting?
We need Rubbermaid.
We should be developing other protocols, and we need more protocols in the world?
Yeah, my argument would be that we actually need to think about developing protocols for point problems and stop trying to boil the ocean every time we come up with one. Solve every problem in the world in every protocol.
So let's get specific. Was EVPN using BGP as the control plane a bad idea? Should we have done it a different way?
So my take on EVPN is I think at the bare root, just like Trill, EVPN is a brilliant idea. I think it gets complex when we try to solve every corner case. If you're going to solve corner cases, don't use BGP. Use BGP for the rough case. It's fine. It's happy. But when we get to the point where we start doing all sorts of strange things and we add all these weird, I mean, have you read the EVPN drafts, Ethan?
Not in detail, no.
Yes. Well, they do hurt. Why did you try to think of every potential corner case on the entire face of the earth and solve them? No. Solve the bare cases. Even if you try to add more stuff later, that's okay, but add them as extensions. Don't stick everything into one big thing. We do this all the time. We do it with everything. HTTP, we're doing the same doggone thing, right? Oh, let's stuff video in there. Ooh, let's stuff video chat in there. Ooh, let's stuff voice in there. Let's stuff everything in there. Yeah. Why don't we not?
Last call. Any more questions for Russ?
Was there something unique about Ethernet and TCP?
Someone make the sound of a cash register ringing.
Yeah, that's about it. It was cheap. But beyond that, so I don't know how many of you go back this far, but I used to work on Tommy Conrad Token Bus. Woohoo! And Token, sorry, and ARCNET. So in the bad old days when we had Token Bus and Token Ring and ARCNET, the reality was Ethernet was reliable. I always say when I started in this industry, I was installing VT100 terminal emulation cards and C100s. You can think about that and figure out what that actually is. So I think it was actually simpler. I think it was more robust because it was simpler and because the point problems were taken on a point-level basis. So in reality, I said Ethernet is no longer Ethernet. Ethernet was never Ethernet. Ethernet has always been a collection of technologies that were built around specific physical layer networking technologies or physical layer technologies, but they worked well enough in framing and marshaling data to work together transparently. Okay, 21st Air Force, we used to run ThickNet through the plenum in 21st Air Force and do taps off of it for each floor. You know what? That's a completely different physical layer than star-built Cat 3 and Cat 3E. But the framing was common enough, and the framing was the same, such that I could connect a ThickNet to a Cat 3E or a Cat 3 switch, and it all just worked. I couldn't do that with Token Ring. I couldn't do that with ARCNET, right? Some ARCNET equipment didn't work with other ARCNET equipment. On and on and on and it went. I could take my Xerox Star system, I could plug it into my Ethernet, my ThickNet network, and poof, it worked. Okay? So that I think those are the reasons that things actually won, is because it was cheap, it was reliable, it was simple enough to work across multiple things, and that was the bottom line. It worked.
Last question for Russ?
1588. Yeah, synchronized Ethernet. I think in some environments it will be. I don't think it will be in most. I think in high-speed trading and things like that, you're going to end up with it. All right, so who actually deploys multicast? Okay, so
there are high-frequency trading apps that do.
Yeah. But by and large, multicast is a very small corner. I mean, we're looking at, so LinkedIn, we're thinking about multicast on our data center fabric, and we keep asking ourselves, we don't have any drivers. I mean, it comes up in conversation, but is video really a driver? No. So what else is there? I mean, there's just the applications just aren't there, really. And by the way, if we did multicast, it would be beer, just to let you know.
BIER, you're talking about the new standard.
Yes, the new standard.
New proposed
IETF working group.
Not beer isn't free, but beer isn't this new thing the IETF's working on.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes. Do you see firewalls in the future looking like they do today? So I was in Cisco TAC when the PICs came out. In fact, I was one of the first people who got access to the source code and actually coded in PICs stuff. Oh, my goodness. I'm really old.
I have a cat named Pix. She's 15.
That's really sad, isn't it, that I said that? Anyway, so to me, firewalls are a bundle of services. Our security people have gotten to the point where you know who Linus is, right? Right? The blue blanket. That's your firewall. Okay? I'm sorry, but it's true. They're little comfort blankets. We like our firewalls. The reality is, firewalls are a bundle of services that can be unbundled and put in the right place at the right time in the network. Okay? I will tell you something very odd. LinkedIn is doing all SSL, TLS encrypted traffic internally and externally. Do you know what happens to a firewall when you shove TLS through it? Yeah. It's kind of useless at that point, right? So just think about that. The more we encrypt traffic, the more we need to move certain services to the edges where the unencrypted traffic actually lives so that we can do the right traffic analysis. Now, I'm not saying that we need to move filtering to the edge. I'm saying we need to move the analysis to the edge, for instance. Deep packet inspection, right? All of these things, these are services. These are not an appliance. We need to get out of thinking about appliances. This is another problem with the networking industry. I'm going to take a load balancer and stick it in front of my network. Well, good. Good luck with that, okay? We treat load balancers as an appliance. Don't do that. It's a service. You can virtualize it. You can stick it anywhere you want to. You can do TCP Anycast. You have lots of solutions to solve the problem at hand. Don't count on the appliances to solve the problem. So that's my opinion about firewalls.
All right, for sake of time, we are going to stop here. Let's give Russ a hand. Oh. Thanks for listening to Packet Pushers today. I'm Ethan Banks. You can tweet at me via @ECBanks. And Russ is routinggeek @RTGGEEK. You can find this and many more fine, free technical podcasts along with our community blog at packetpushers.net. Follow us on Twitter @packetpushers. Find us on LinkedIn. Like us on Facebook and rate us on iTunes. Last but not least, remember that too much networking would never be enough.